Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, commentary, and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. And you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett, as well as exclusive bonus footage by becoming a member, patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Right now, we're live on Twitch with this new segment. Make sure to follow the numbers at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. And again, we begin each show with a little bit of the news that you might have missed, but should be on your radar. So without further ado, the news. Our first story comes from OPB. It's by April Elric and Jen Chavez and Tiffany Cammy. It's called Oregon Nonprofits Ask for $100 Million Federal Investment to Address White Supremacy. The nonprofits, or per the article, the nonprofits, including the Latino Network, Unite Oregon, PCUN, CASA, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization Verde, and APANO, provide services to the communities of color. In a joint letter addressed to President Joe Biden, they say Oregon is susceptible to domestic terrorist attacks against people of color. They are asking the administration to invest in two areas: federal agencies that can increase surveillance and prosecutions, and community-based organizations that can increase social and health services. Later in the article, they write, the letter notes that Oregon ranks sixth in the nation in the number of violent extremist attacks between 2011 and 2020, according to an advisory report by the Oregon Secretary of State's office. The report, published in March, suggests new laws and policies that could help the state prevent extremist attacks. Oregon is one of only 16 states that doesn't have a law defining and outlawing domestic terrorism and violent extremism. These cases are usually handled by the federal government, but the report recommends Oregon lawmakers come up with state laws that can help cases where federal laws fall short. So, as a lot of people know, Oregon is considered by some the Mississippi of the West, but it is important as a place that fashions itself as a liberal bastion, which allows for a lot of this white supremacist organizing to go under the radar, to actually put real resources towards this. Some of you may have forgotten that in the early days of the Trump administration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions actually pulled a bunch of monies directly dealing with and engaging white supremacy and trying to repress white supremacist organizing. And it's not a coincidence that we've seen growth in these areas when those resources are gone. And that's not just policing, but also specifically organizations that, you know, work to deal with people like on a human level. I think it was something like After Hate. I can't remember the name off the top of my head right now, that literally work with reforming white supremacists and doing, you know, the people who've come from that movement and doing that work. So again, we'll keep our eyes on this request and see what the Biden administration does, because right now the Biden administration is falling a little bit short despite its, they really love black voters in 2020, but it'd really be nice if they could show us some of that love afterwards. We're going into the midterms, but I digress. Our next story comes from Willamette Week. It's by Sophie Peel, titled Laurelhurst Homeowners Attempted to Deter Park Camping with Large Planters Without Necessary Permits. So according to the article, on Saturday, a group of people in the Laurelhurst neighborhood installed over two dozen planter boxes along a street adjacent to Laurelhurst Park in an effort to deter unhoused campers from moving their tents back in. Photos shared with Willamette Week taken by activists who support unhoused campers show about 10 people shoveling soil and gravel from two large mounds into wheelbarrows that are then awkwardly deposited into the planters, which look like water troughs. Oregon fence or orange fencing likely put up by the city after a recent sweep. The city posted oak and 37th for the removal in the last week of May surrounds the planters. By Sunday morning, someone had dismantled and removed all the planter boxes. The remnants left on Monday were sparse. Just small mounds of dirt and gravel dotted the parking strip. The orange fencing was balled up and left on the sidewalk and street. Further in the article, it's not the only recent example of property owners taking such initiatives. Last week, the Portland Mercury reported that prominent developer Jordan Snitzer installed bike racks outside of one of his Northwest buildings. Though Snitzer didn't respond to a request for comment, observers speculated that he installed the racks to deter campers. So this story represents just one of the latest battles between, be frank, housing, well, not just developers, but neighbors of a certain persuasion and wealth, you know, trying to take anti-homeless measures into their own hands, and activists fighting against that. And really, when you boil it all down, this is what's happening when you're getting a lack of larger state and institutional action. We're in the midst of an ever-growing houseless crisis. And you've got people, some people don't care about houseless people, trying to take it into their own hands. Activists on the other side trying to take it into their own hands. And you have these proxy battles. But meanwhile, the larger crisis is only getting worse. And we need real investment. We need real mass solutions, not just, you know, vigilante action. So we'll continue to ring the bell for the state to jump in a way that's actually compassionate and effective, not just sweeping people and moving them to another location for the same things to happen again. Our next story also comes from OPB. It's by Elizabeth Miller. It's titled, "Hundreds of Oregon Nonprofits Barred from Children's Summer Program Funds Due to Insurance Requirement." So according to the article, at a Senate Education Committee meeting on the same day as Gill's update, OAESD officials shared that 320 applicants were submitted so far, or applications were submitted so far for funding, but, quote, very, very few applicants, unquote, have really required insurance. They include hundreds of organizations planning to serve youth of color, youth experiencing disabilities, children from rural communities, and children navigating poverty, homelessness, or foster care. All students the state has committed to serving, especially after years of disrupted learning. Gill said state officials have been working to find a solution to allow, quote, hundreds of CBOs and tribes to access affordable insurance options, unquote. But the coverage for these types of programs was unavailable or would take too much time to process before the start of the summer. Further in the article, last summer, the Oregon Community Foundation oversaw a distribution of $41 million in grant funds, but did not have the same issue. An FAQ document for this summer's grant application process said applicants were asked if they had insurance, but verification was not required. According to the document, that approach placed organizations and possibly the Oregon Community Foundation at, quote, greater risk. Without the opportunity for funding, some small organizations are trying to come up with other ideas or scaling back original plans. So this is your classic big bank tank little bank story. Large organizations, established organizations, white-run and wealthy, white-run organizations are not dealing with this problem. They can cover the insurance, they have the resources, but the organizations closest to the ground, closest to the people in need, in this case, we're talking about programs specifically serving youth, are struggling. So either they're going to have to scale back their services, change their services, or not provide them at all over what eventually amount or what basically amounts to bureaucratic paperwork and, you know, insurance requirements that not everyone can meet, or at least cannot meet without a financial sponsor. We don't have time in this news segment to get into all the wonders of the nonprofit world and, again, all the bureaucracy that goes into that. But ultimately, these policies and these roadblocks, they hurt providers from marginalized communities. They hurt the recipients, in this case, the youth recipients of these services who need them the most, and then shift them to people who don't necessarily have the community connection or, you know, don't necessarily have, again, that proximity to really provide the services in the most effective way. So we hope these requirements and these systems can be fixed in a way that can be more equitable. But again, we'll keep our eye out. And in a lot of cases, we'll be out here finding ways to fill in these gaps. Our last story comes from the Oregonian. It's titled State Will Pay Cost of College for Oregon Tribal Members Going to School in State, and it's by Sammy Edge. According to the article, the legislature funded the Oregon Tribal Student Grant Program to the tune of $19 million for 2022 through 23. Maximum grants will cover the average cost of attendance, including tuition, books, housing, and more for tribal members who attend an in-state community, college, or university. Students seeking the grant will have to submit a federal application for student aid or an Oregon student aid application, along with submitting a grant application. The tribal student grant will help cover the difference between state or federal aid a student receives and the average cost of attendance at their in-state school. That can be a big gap. In 2021-22, the maximum federal Pell Grant was around $6,500, and the maximum Oregon Opportunity Grant was around $3,600. The average cost of attending an Oregon school in comparison was around $21,000 for community college and $28,000 at a public university. The percentage of Oregon's Native American students attending college after high school has declined in recent years. According to a 2021 commission report, only 48% of Oregon's Native American high school graduates enrolled in college within 16 months of high school, compared to 61% of students overall. College completion rates point to another disparity. About 52% of Native American students in Oregon's public universities finish their degrees within 6 years, compared to 67% of all students. The grant is expected to pay for most or all costs for undergraduate students at a public school. Students attending private nonprofit schools in Oregon and graduate programs can apply as well, though the grant would be capped at the maximum cost of attendance at the public university. So there's two things that come to my mind when I read this article. First of all, when we're talking about equity for Native students in Oregon in particular, obviously this grant doesn't cover everything, but it's a step in the right direction towards, you know, providing access to higher education, the opportunities those provide. Also, when we talk about the larger discussion of, you know, what does equity look like? What does reparations look like? I ask as a Black man in this state, because, you know, people often frame the conversation around direct payments, but it's also other things like, you know, is it healthcare? Is it access to free college or, you know, subsidized college and higher education? Because that can be, it's a huge equalizer and becoming less of one because the economy is messed up in a variety of ways, but it's still a big factor in being able to get job opportunities and being able to create your own opportunities and making connections and knowing the landscape of this world. College, the university experience, secondary school, trade school, these different things are huge, huge factors in, you know, the prosperity of our youth out here. So we look at these programs both in as far as like the specific populations they serve, but then also the larger implications in terms of, again, how are we going to dole out different paths of justice and different paths towards equity that genuinely serve and empower people. So we'll keep our eyes on this program. Again, they note that the funds are for 2022 through 23. So even this program is not, you know, set going forward, even though it seems like an obvious one that it should be. And that's the news. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
games? Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. So a little inside baseball for the viewers. My first time being back in the studio in like a month or a month and a half.
About so.
And, you know, one of the things that happened since I was last here is we aired our live segment from the Welcome Dome. And I think the many things happened at the Welcome Dome, but one was me introducing a segment that I'm not segment, but a movement that is sure to, you know, catch fire across the nation.
Catch on at some point.
I'll bite maybe slowly based on that. But it was called the White Silence Movement.
Yes, it was.
For those who weren't there, this is a really simple concept. Basically, white people for like a year. You know, you can do more if you want to, but just take a vow of silence. Like, literally, just don't talk.
Don't say anything.
It's all listening and, you know, doing some things. I imagine you got to like feed yourself or something, but just for a year. And let's see what happens. Like if all the white people in the world just went silent, because I know people think, but what about all these things that white people are contributing and all these thoughts? And it's like, but you know, who also has those thoughts and also has things to contribute?
Those contributions.
Everyone else. In fact, you might find out some things you didn't even know about.
Very true.
So what if we just did that for a year? Now, the thing was, when I pitched that, and I should expect this, when you're, you know, when you have big ideas.
We're going to change the world.
Exactly. You know, people aren't going to see the vision in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, Ado, I know you had some concerns.
I did.
Ambush was there too. He had some concerns.
Some audience members had some concerns.
But you know what? I still remember we had one white person came up, was ready to join the movement. So we started from somewhere. But you know what? Never let it be said that I am not, you know, that I don't take feedback. That I don't, you know, let it roll around my head a little bit, and I'm willing to retool ideas. I'm willing to, you know, adjust. So I've been thinking about it. Okay, people, you know, the White Silence Movement, people were a little nervous. They're like, I remember you asked, like, what are white people going to do? I'd rather hear what people are saying, because I'm a little worried about how they might organize. I'm a little worried how they might, you know, after a year, what's going to happen? How are they going to come back, right? So I thought about it. I retooled, I repackaged, and I was like, now this is going to be a little, I'm not going to say controversial, because the whole impetus for this segment is the White Silence Movement.
Yeah.
But actually, I want to borrow one of the few semi-useful ideas Kanye West has put out in recent years. Mm-hmm. You know, he bought a compound in Wyoming?
He did. Quite a bit of land.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, I don't know about Kanye, but this whole thing about land and compounds. Wait, what if we turn the White Silence Movement into the anti-racism monastery?
Yeah.
So it's still a vow of silence, but we put a little more organizing around it. We have land. Mm-hmm. We could provide clothes, which ironically, as I envision them, would probably look a lot like, you know, Kanye's weird Jesus wear. Again, I don't know why so many of these ideas are kind of parallel to Kanye West in this moment.
Kanye right now.
That might be the next retool for this segment.
You got to separate it from Kanye a little bit.
Yeah, that's the next We're workshopping in real time here. So, you know, you have people, they come to the monastery again. They dedicate a year or more. Maybe they just want to stay there for the rest of their lives. Like, monasteries currently exist.
Yeah.
Like, there's a model for this. And, you know, we could have educators, trainers. Like, you will go there and you'll be in silence, but you will have work to do.
Yeah.
You will do plenty of learning in, you know, this compound environment and with the guidance and the containment. In theory, you can come back out, or maybe you never come back out. Maybe you just stay there.
Maybe you stay there forever.
And think again. If everyone just commits a year, in fact, not even if everyone commits a year, because we all know.
Yeah.
Well, most of the white people, they're not going to commit to this monastery.
Yes.
But those who do, when we let them loose on those who haven't, I'm just saying.
Okay, we can work on this.
Like, so what I'm asking, Ado, are you warming up?
You brought up a decent point in the concept of, so let's say we have a few, like, let's just take like Portland, for example. Portland shoots they shot as the liberal area, as we know. So let's just say, like, we are able to get, like out of 100 white people, we get 50 Portlanders, those liberals, to pop in. And for a year, they join the monastery. They learn lessons. They take that time to grow as a person. Maybe there's even moments where it's like, you know, like when white people, like, start crying really hard over a black experience when it's uncomfortable and like they're not, like, it's weird when they do that. Maybe we talk to them about that and we're like, hey, what are you doing? Like, we teach them. By the time that they come out, then we'll be able to, not only will they be able to get other white people to be like, hey, that was a good year. Like, I learned a lot. I learned some lessons. So then we get some new recruits, but then any other white people who are completely out of order, we now have well-educated white people to deal with them so then we can sit back and relax.
I feel you warm enough to the idea. Yeah.
Because the thing with the white silence movement is that having it be like the public hashtag, you know how white people get about these public hashtags, like something's going to happen. I don't want to see you get canceled, Bruce. I don't want white people to cancel you.
Oh.
They'll be like, this racist man. But if you make it a monastery, if it's completely by choice, if it's an experience, it's like that's a year-long experience of silence that you're choosing.
Let's be real. You know, obviously the anti-racism monastery is going to have a hard push towards the white population. But there's some other people that could definitely, they could stand to spend some time in the anti-racism monastery too. So it's open to everyone.
It's open to everybody. I think making it open-ended, like anyone can pop in, learn some lessons, come out, grow.
Yeah. And let's just take it, you know, because obviously the issue is going to come up. Well, where are you going to get the funding, Bruce? Where are you going to get the money? Oh, there are plenty of people that I think potential sponsors who would have a real incentive in this. So where are you going to build compounds? Well, again, weirdly enough, Kanye has shown us the way.
Yes.
And Wyoming, honestly, Dakotas,
Idaho,
Montana, Idaho, these places already exist.
Yes.
And let's be real. We talk about this middle America, quote unquote, middle America voting problem. If you were going to try and, I don't know, infuse a more level playing field, you know, for your senatorial votes, for your legislatures, yeah, build communities there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bring people there. How do you bring a bunch of people? Oh, that's right. jobs or a jobs program.
Yep.
And this, these aren't even jobs. These are the monastery experience. Well, they actually are jobs because we will put these white people to work.
Yes. Yes.
Please. I want people to know. Let me look right into the camera. We will put these white people to work. If you establish these communities, these compounds, you activate people because, yeah, you're taking a vow of silence.
Mm-hmm.
But please believe you will still be filling out that ballot.
Yeah.
You're going to vote.
You're doing the work. I'm curious, how are you going to avoid people calling it a cult?
See, I don't even worry about that. Like, people think it's a cult. Well, you know what else is a cult? You checked out the Republican Party lately?
Fair.
Like, what? Cult.
Very fair.
I think cult is actually like the branding model on most of social media, if you look right now.
That's very true.
Like, yes, in theory, a cult is not the greatest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone is running their marketing like a cult.
Yeah.
Is, the whole cult of personality thing. Yes, but no, I mean, literally, like, listen to me. I have the answers for you. Buy my this.
Uh-huh.
Buy my that. I'm the only one that can save you. Like, that's the model right now anyway.
Yeah, that's just the life model.
Shame me for being a cult. The cult of anti-racism. That's the cult true, you're mad at?
True,
hmm?
True.
Hmm? I'm already getting ready. Like, I'm getting ready to... I like how I'm just, like, arguing with hypothetical people as you ask me speeches. This question right now. But... No, I think, again, you keep throwing these questions out and telling you, anti-racism monastery, if we were live again, I feel like we got one last time. I feel like we could get five.
Mm, I agree. I think for all intents and purposes, I'm down with this one. I'm definitely down with this one. Because also, we're putting the white people somewhere else as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like... Otherwise, we just kind of get to do our own thing. We don't get to see these specific white people who end up joining for a year. I think we also get to keep around the most extreme white people, which I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how that separation happens because like the white people who are just refusing to join, like let's say like this program runs for 10 years and like, you have the choice to stay as long as you want, but you only need to stay for a year. The very extreme white people who just don't want to join are going to be the forefront of white society now. And that'll be interesting.
Hmm. So you do present a real problem in that interim of the wildest white people being the only white people. On segment three of the ever-evolving white silence movement / anti-racism monastery, I'm going to come up with an answer for that one.
Yeah, because we got to deal with those extremists. Like, we can't expect the Grand Wizard to just go into the monastery.
But I'm just saying, I feel like the legs are coming together. Yes. And you know what's nice about this? Because most people are like, you shouldn't talk about this on like a screen and record it and put it out there for people. I feel very comfortable workshopping this idea because, what's the worst that can happen? We actually do it?
We figure it out.
what are we actually going to create this monastery, create a bunch of jobs for people to run the monastery, mm-hmm. Create a major political shift by plotting these all throughout quote unquote middle America.
Yep.
Transforming lives. Oh no.
That's
the
worst scenario.
Yeah. And then we just, make sure we need to find some wealthy benefactors so mm-hmm. we can own the land yes. with the compounds. Because again, if you're, if you're an investor or sponsor for this, you want to make sure black people own land, don't
yes.
you? That'd be a basic one. We're not going to do the Black News Channel thing where, the owner of the Jaguar is like, I'm a big investor. I don't feel like it. I'm pulling out.
Right.
We're not going to do that. shout out to whatever his name is. No, we're going to invest. We're going to own the land.
Yeah.
So even if it doesn't
create
work.
Jobs, create communities.
We'll figure out other ways to do stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, so if you're watching in Idaho, Wyoming, South Dakota, North Dakota.
Hit us up. I know. Yeah. I got people in Idaho watching this. I have friends in Idaho. Hit us up.
Yeah, I was thinking about the other people who are watching this who are like, this is what we're afraid of.
Do they have entertainment? Like, can they watch movies? Can they, like...
You know, that's to be determined.
Uh-huh.
It's to be determined. You're asking these questions about, you know, how humanely are you going to treat the people?
And I think that's a good place to get started.
These are important questions. Yes. Yes, they are. We'll get there. We'll get there. I feel like we gotta wrap this while we're still in a positive place before you ask too much.
Well, okay. I feel the thing is, by you answering the question the way you did, we're workshopping it. This is a live workshop for anyone listening. We're figuring things out.
Exactly. There will be compassion.
Yes.
Again, I look at the camera, which makes it seem so much more sincere, but don't you worry.
We care.
We do.
We care. We care more than you've cared about us, honestly.
You know, I think we can wrap the segment there. That no matter what you think about the movement, we care more than you've cared about us.
Yep.
So trust us and join the anti-racism monastery.
Welcome.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Happy May, everyone. It's Bruce Poinsett. We're back for our feature newsletter interview. Special guest Evan Segura, who's with me today. Evan is a young Chicano organizer, mental health counselor, and current president of the Portland Psychedelic Society. He played a key role in passing Measure 109 and 110, which legalized psilocybin services and decriminalized personal amounts of all drugs in Oregon. He's also an amateur mycologist and has taught thousands of people how to develop the right to relationship with mushrooms and cultivate their own medicine. He spends most of his time organizing within psychedelic community, stomping around the forest, looking at mushrooms, and riding his motorcycle along the coast. And right now I'm jealous because he's broadcasting in from beautiful Mexico while Portland is dreary as hell right now. But that said, Evan, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing beautiful. I'm blessed. I'm extremely grateful to be alive and extremely grateful to be on your show. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Yeah, and I'm honestly happy to have you. You know, it's interesting with just the discussion around psychedelics and thinking about just how much it's evolved, because it wasn't really that long ago, at least for me anyway, it felt like, you know, something like, it's kind of like something you had to like whisper about. Like, it wasn't really, you know, a discussion in the mainstream. I remember having I was literally talking with someone this weekend where, you know, I was just kind of like almost like dancing, because I was talking about, you know, my excitement kind of about this interview, actually. I was like, yeah, have you done the way you kind of like dance around? Like, yeah, I'm not sure if you've, you know, done mushrooms before. And the person's like, yeah, a couple times. Like, oh, yeah, that's right. It's 2022. I always have to remind myself. But yeah, just to start off, can you just talk about, you know, we're going to get into like your work and kind of your just journey with psychedelics, but can you just talk about how the conversation has evolved? And I think just in your line of work, like, what's the biggest misconception people bring to you when it comes to mushrooms in particular and psychedelics in general?
I think the biggest misconception that people bring is that mushrooms are these bad drugs that are in your mind that are making you gonna go crazy. So many people are so brainwashed from the failed miseducation of the war on drugs you know, that started in the early 70s and went on into the late 80s and 90s and still exists today. I mean, drug education that we teach our children in school that I'm sure you've heard, Bruce, and I know I've heard in school through the DARE program is complete bullshit, honestly, like all lies. If anything, they make drugs seem pretty interesting to a lot of kids, you know, just I think the opposite of what they're trying to do. But I think the normalization of psychedelics is a really cool thing. I've had very similar experiences the last couple of weeks, just been at, you know, bars around Portland and just overhearing an incredible amount of conversations about mushrooms. Just everybody's talking about their last mushroom trip or the next upcoming mushroom trip or what microdosing is doing for their lives right now. And it's, it's surreal. But I'm born and raised in Chicago, and it was a huge culture shock even 3 years ago for me to come to Portland and understand just how comfortable everybody is talking about drugs like psychedelics and marijuana. You know, people just smoking, you know, blunts on the street. It's awesome. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think it's so cool. But it's wild. A new world. For sure.
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. talked in the intro a little bit about measures 109 and 110 and the passage, mm-hmm. but you know, I know there's a lot of people who probably just like seen this on the periphery, but are wondering, okay, so what do these legalization measures mean? What do they, mm-hmm. what do they allow and what do they not allow? And where's the next frontier in this, the legalization fight?
Yeah. So measure 109 legalizes the use of psilocybin in a regulated medical system. So you can go to registered and licensed service centers and take a dose of mushrooms with a licensed psilocybin facilitator. And that is the only way that you can legally use psilocybin mushrooms as of right now in Oregon. So anyone else, you know, doing mushrooms in any other setting claiming that it's legal is just miseducated, that's all. Measure 110 decriminalized personal amounts of all drugs. You can have up to 12 grams of psilocybin containing material, 40 hits of LSD, which I don't consider a personal amount, but if you do, you know, that's I'm not exactly sure on the exact amounts of all the other drugs, but it's just decriminalized, which means that police cannot make it a priority to bust somebody just because they are suspicious that they have drugs on them. And if they do have drugs on them and they're found while, you know, getting hassled or, you know, arrested for something else, then they can only get $100 fine. It's like a parking ticket, you know, and they can also get out of that fine by taking a mental health assessment test through the OHA, through the Measure 110 system. So you go, you take this test, you talk to somebody and they gauge whether or not, you know, you're addicted to a certain substance and you need help and you should really check out some recovery services that Measure 110 also provided a ton of funding for. So in the last 2 years, a lot of recovery and treatment centers in Portland and across the state have gotten a huge amount of funding directed their way to just increase those services for people that are struggling. The last question, you know, that you asked is just like, what is next? I agree, yeah. Bruce, but it's just the, I think the next frontier is full decriminalization. We kind of have this like decriminalization with an asterisk sign after it, where we're really just trying to help. We're trying to help people that are addicted to harder drugs that really need support. But all of the people that just want to, you know, go to the coast and, you know, a couple grams of mushrooms with their friends and go on a hike or even hang out in their backyards are technically, you know, committing a felony. And I see full decriminalization as the next kind of move forward for people to be able to feel completely safe using whatever they want to use for however and why ever they want to use it. Because while we have personal use decriminalized, that doesn't decriminalize the sale of any of these substances. That doesn't decriminalize the growing or manufacturing of any of these substances. So we're basically saying, I mean, we're basically just turning a blind eye to everything else that's going on when, you know, shout out to all of the drug dealers and drug manufacturers in the world that are making these beautiful experiences possible for us and taking a huge, huge risk in doing so. And they shouldn't really have to do that, you know? I mean, a lot of us in the psychedelic industry are watching this wave of wealthy, white, rich men come in from the cannabis industry, ready to pour their tens of millions that they have stolen from that market into this new market. And now there's all these folks that have been doing this for a really long time in a really safe and responsible way that are about to just get swept either out of the market or into a cage in prison because there's now competition, you know, in what they're supposed to be doing. So I think it's extremely important to fully decriminalize as soon as possible.
So that kind of transitions into the work of the Portland Psychedelic Society. And you know, we talked earlier, you lived and worked, you know, both around the country, around the world. But first off, just when did you move to Portland, and then when did you get started with the Portland Psychedelic Society?
Yeah. So I moved to Portland in January of 2019, the fall before. I was actually hitchhiking with a friend from Canada through Portland and just happened to catch Portland Psychedelic Society meeting that they were hosting with this dude, Paul Stamets, who's a really famous mycologist. And I met this guy named Matt at this meeting, and he told me that he was sitting for people underground and facilitating these psilocybin experiences. And I've been doing mushrooms since I was 13. I think that they are magical allies that we have been blessed with on this planet. And so I was fascinated by the work this man was doing, and studying grow mushrooms at the time. And so I started talking to him about growing them, and he said he's never tried it. Long story short, 2 months later, this guy invites me to live with him and his family on Mount Tabor in exchange for helping him grow his own medicine for his own clients. And he started kind of teaching me the ways of sitting for people and delivering experiences. And I thought it was, and I still think it is, the coolest job that I've ever had. I can't tell you how much like purpose and meaning it brings to my life to be able to share these transformative experiences with people and make sure that there's a safe, empathetic person there to kind of walk them through the whole process and make them feel comfortable. And that person started bringing me to the Portland Psychedelic Society, and I started connected to the community and to the campaigns that were going on to make this medicine more accessible, or, you know, as most accessible as we thought was possible in 2019. I think the bar is much, much higher now that we've done a lot of the research and it's been normalized, and a million people, you know, voted yes for psilocybin in 2020. I think it kind of broadened our horizons, but we haven't really lived up to that quite yet.
Yeah. And yeah, I was just browsing the PPS site, and you know, one of the things that really, really caught my eye is just like, you all have just these really, it's like a thorough list of like different groups, whether it be like a BIPOC mm-hmm. group, queer group, veterans mm-hmm. group. And, you know, it just, I mean, one, just in, you know, cultivating and facilitating, like just some stuff with my work, I'm just looking at all these different groups and saying, wow, that's a lot. But at the same, it got me just thinking, like, you know, what is, like, one, is there such thing as like a typical day at Portland Psychedelic Society? And if so, like, what does that look like?
Yeah. a typical day. So we're a very young nonprofit. We've only been registered for a few years, and we're an all-volunteer nonprofit. We've never gotten, you know, corporate sponsorship or funding in that degree. So the organization has shifted and transitioned a lot with any, like any volunteer organization. We're growing a lot in the last few months because of, you know, how close we're getting to the Measure 109 rollout and how important, you know, a lot of people are really realizing our group is going to be to the success of this program. Like you said, we've got so many different groups, 17 monthly groups that are completely free to attend. Anyone can join. You know, we work so hard to provide these, you know, these brave spaces for people to share these experiences that so many folks have been holding in their entire lives. We see relief, you know, for people when they just get to be in a space where everybody kind of understands what they went through in that experience. And a lot of people that understand the fear of folks that have never tried these substances, you know, and are able to provide that support as well. I think it's really important that we have all these different affinity groups because folks just more comfortable to their own communities, you know. The queer group, the BIPOC support group, we have in a group for neurodivergent folks that are on the spectrum. There's so many different factors that go into having like your own unique psychedelic experience. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that, you know, as a community, as a city, there's different ways to do these substances, and we all have accept that. I think that's one of the biggest struggles of Measure 109 is we're trying to figure out what is the one size fits all mushroom experience we can sell to every single Oregonian. And the truth is, there's not one. This is going to have to be a diverse program to make everybody feel welcome and everybody feel at home, especially because they're about to be, you know, in one of the most vulnerable states of consciousness that they've ever been in their entire lives, you know, after using these medicines. So we really got to make people feel accepted and welcome and like there's a place for them, you know, in this city, in this community, after they have this experience and as they integrate that. So every week we have four or five different groups. And an average day at the Portland Psychedelic Society just looks like working with the head volunteers at the office or communicating through Slack just to make sure that the whole kind of system is running smoothly. But we're putting a lot of energy into an event that we're hosting later in June 25th and 26th, the Psychedelic Symposium. And it's going to be a large community gathering of local experts and legislators and researchers and organizational leaders so that all the folks in Portland, you know, can come through and meet the people that are shaping this movement, you know, and really learn about what they're trying to do and how they're trying to do it and how it's going to, how can people get involved? I mean, the Portland Psychedelic Society is the third largest psychedelic society in the world. There's not that many regions of the world where psychedelics are making this, you know, this huge comeback. And in a lot of ways, it's making history. Like there's never been such a large attempt to bring psychedelics back into the mainstream and reintegrate it into our lives anywhere in the world other than what Oregon is doing right now. So yeah, it's a lot to carry, but I think there's an incredible amount of intelligent, brilliant minds in Portland working to make this happen in a way that is going to help a lot of people. So
before I let you get out of here and get back to vacation, I did want to talk about the psychedelic symposium coming up. Can you just, yep, again, remind people one of the dates and then two, like what can people expect who are interested in attending?
So the last conference that we had was in 2019, and we had 800 people attend at the Revolution Hall And it was this huge, huge event. We had, we flew in, you know, psychedelic leaders from all over the country. We had Clindy E from Detroit, James Fadiman, who's a microdosing expert from San Francisco, Anthony Bossis, Rachel Harris from Seattle, like all these, you know, incredible, brilliant researchers, psychedelic minds. But what I want to be, what I want more people to be aware of is just how proud they should be of what is happening in their own city right here in Portland. There's enough, you know, incredible research and like social research, just different organizations like the Portland Psychedelic Society trying to do something new and kind of unheard of, you know, to fill up a whole week of presentations and panels and talks like that. So our keynote speakers are Hanifa Naya Washington. She helped co-found this project called the Fireside Project. And this is a phone number that anybody in the United States can call and be connected to a person to talk about psychedelic experiences with. They could be like tripping, you know, on the phone, or they can be coming down from a trip and just need some support. You know, they could be preparing for a trip and they just need some words of affirmation and advice. So Hanifa is going to be talking about what it's been like to kind of roll out that that hotline and what they've learned from all these people tripping all over the country and calling in for help. They've helped prevent like over 1,000 calls to police and to emergency services because they were able to just talk someone through it, you know? Someone was kind of freaking out, kind of thought that they were going a little crazy. And instead of calling the cops and having an ambulance come and having this extremely traumatic experience, they just got connected to this nice person on the phone that was able to talk them through what they were going through and go through some breathing exercises, assure them everything was going to be cool. And that's a revolutionary tool that our community is going to have access to for forever. I just want to shout out the phone number is 62-Fireside or 623-473-7433. So save that in your phone. You never know when you're going to need it. You never know when you're going to have to, you know, give that number to a friend or something like that. But I really think anyone using drugs, especially psychedelic drugs, should have that there just in case. So Hanifa is going to be talking about that. And then our other keynote speaker, Chris Stauffer, is a researcher that works at the VA and at OHSU, doing some incredible research on the efficacy of psilocybin and its ability to treat depression. And he's also doing some of the first research on group ceremonies in the United States and how can we, you know, use these medicines together in an effective way to help treat mental illnesses for folks. So he's doing some really incredible work. We've got Dr. Pilar Hernandez from Lewis and Clark University talking about colonization and cultural appropriation in psychedelics. We've got Nyanga Uuka from the House of Jah City talking about providing space in psychedelics for marginalized communities. Talise Katura from Ancestral Seed talking about ways to develop rituals and a relationship with your ancestors through psychedelics and plant medicine. Laura Riley talking about ethics of touch in psychedelic spaces, how we should be holding each other, different ways and consensual methods for us to have the safest experience. It's going to be a really, really incredible gathering of folks this summer. And we're hoping to start to have these symposiums at least twice a year to just be able to get everybody together and strengthen our community and educate our community on what's happening. You know, I mean, there's a lot happening all over the world right now. This is a global psychedelic movement, but Portland is one of the leaders, you know, if not the leader in the psychedelic movement in the whole planet. And we got to be really proud about that and figure out how can we best work together, you know?
Awesome. Well, yeah, Evan Segura, president of the Portland Psychedelic Society. Thank you again for taking the time and, you know, helping to shed some light on the psychedelic movement, and also, again, Portland Psychedelic Symposium, June 25th, 26th at the Alberta Abbey. Mark your calendars. And this has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, Black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.